Business, big and small, is shaping our economy, our present and our future. But it's a loud and busy world out there, and you need voices you trust to unpack the big stories and ask the right questions. I'm Carrington Clark, host of the new podcast, ABC Business Daily. Monday to Thursday, we take the big business stories and break them down. What happened? Why it happened? Who it helps? Who it hurts? Search for ABC Business Daily on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wondery Country, I'm Luke Sidham Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, after One Nation wins big in Farah, the Prime Minister lays the boot into the coalition.
The Liberal Party and National Party made a big mistake legitimising One Nation and saying in adopting many of their policies, but a lighter version of them, and then following that up by giving them preferences, they were saying effectively that it was okay to vote for One Nation rather than the traditional Conservative parties.
So where could One Nation turn its attention next?
This is a dynamic change, and talking to people last night in the western suburbs of Sydney, they're quite at home with the idea of One Nation being a dominant force in Western Sydney. Absolutely 100% on board with the idea.
Both the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and Nationals defector turned One Nation MP, Barnaby Joyce, will be in your ears in a moment. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Good to have you with us this Monday on The Breakfast Wrap. It is budget week, so plenty of federal political interviews coming up every single day. But before we look ahead, we're going to have to look back to the weekend.
So if you're just joining us, tonight we're bringing you special coverage of the Farah by-election.
We are 2 hours into the count, and we're going to go to Casey Briggs.
Very clear to us now. The next member for Farah is David Farley. One Nation has broken through in the lower house of federal parliament.
And that is history in the making.
The recriminations inside the Liberal Party are already beginning, I can tell you, because I've seen them in my own phone.
For nearly 80 years, this seat of Farah in regional New South Wales has been held by the Nationals and the Liberals. One Nation has not been able to win in its own right a lower house seat. That changes tonight with David Farley's win. Pauline Hanson's party now has 2 seats in the lower house.
So let's kick off today with one of the people who holds one of those 2 seats, the former National turned One Nation MP, Barnaby Joyce. He joins Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast this morning, and here's what she asked him first.
What's the message from the Farah by-election in your view?
The message is a more sort of pragmatic approach to economics, a more realistic approach to immigration, an understanding that the Australian nation has to come first. And let's go through a couple of policy reasons that sit behind that. The climate change department has not changed the climate. It has brought about and been part of record insolvencies in small business. There are massive savings to be made by removing the climate change department, removing climate change policy. We have to be pragmatic. We have to be adults. We have to move back to what we can actually do, which is coal fire power. We have to understand that without cheap energy, you just do not have the capacity to succeed in business. And this eternal promise that things will get better in the future, just hang around and wait for it. People are over that, just like they've changed their votes. In other areas, excuse me, Sally, such as immigration, it's not that you're against immigration, but there has to be a pragmatism about this. The idea that you can have a complete change in the social construct of Australia without creating heat, without creating disunity, without making life difficult for our children and our grandchildren now and into the future is foolishness, and it was proved foolishness in the tragic circumstances of such places as Bondi. These are decisions some people may find and unpalatable, but others will see that as finally they are getting the alternative for people to tell you as it is.
It's a long way from winning 1 seat in the House of Reps to being able to be part of government. You were talking on Saturday night about look out for seats in Western Sydney. Does One Nation realistically see that as a next target right now?
How often have we had people say, does One Nation, are people over, especially in the media, saying, does One Nation realistically? And that just belies the fact that the polls, multiple polls, have now been corroborated by an election in South Australia, now a federal election in New South Wales. It's a choice of the people as to who the government of Australia is. And what we do see is major parties, they can't think of any other reason why they should be getting rid of One Nation but the sort of conceited statement, oh, you're not a party of government. Well, let's finish that with a rejoinder, yet.
How do you see the potential for One Nation right now?
It's as far as the Australian people want it to go, I suspect. And, you know, as things evolve over time, the base broadens and the skill sets by reason of your numbers coming in also increase. And therefore, it is up to One Nation and it's up to the deliberations and the views of the Australian people as to where they end up.
What's the message for the major parties from this result in Farah on the weekend?
Democracy is alive and well and dynamic, and people will make choices. And if you do not sober up and start asking yourself this question, why is it that there is an island off the Malaysian Peninsula with no coal, no oil, no gas, no cattle, no irrigation, no uranium, and it has an economy, and it's called Singapore, and has an economy about a quarter to a third of the size of Australia. And the difference between their future, and they have got three distinct ethnic groups, and they managed to keep them together, the difference between them and us is called management. And unless you get the management right, then the future and the potential of Australia is lost.
Do you think that some of your former coalition colleagues will join you?
Well, that's a question for them. And there's two parts to that. Their desire to join and our desire to have them. It's not just because you jump doesn't mean we catch you.
What does that mean?
Well, it's not an open door that anybody who wishes just walks into One Nation, just like anybody who wishes just can't walk into the Labor Party, the Liberal Party, or I imagine the National Party. I mean, obviously the Liberal Party really do have to do some soul searching after the weekend because that was catastrophic. That's almost a signal that things might be over.
One Nation MP Barnaby Joyce there. Well, one person who'll be hoping it's not over is the Shadow Foreign Minister, Ted O'Brien. During Susan Lee's opposition, he was the Deputy Opposition Leader. Her resignation is what triggered the Farah by-election. And Ted O'Brien's regional seat of Fairfax is now squarely in Pauline Hanson's sights. So Sally asked him what lessons the coalition might hope to learn from this loss in Farah.
The Australian people look at the system at the moment and they think it's broken. If I think of some of the towns in my own electorate, you walk down the street and there are empty shops, there are closing down signs. You have everyday hardworking Australians just struggling to make ends meet. They don't think the economy's working for them. Real wages are going down. Businesses are going insolvent. You have everything from, you know, live music venues to everyday cafes closing their doors because Australians simply can't pay for things. Inflation is just going ballistic at the moment. And of course, we know the impact of interest rates. Now, these are the things that are affecting everyday Australians. I believe Labor is making the situation worse. I think One Nation is doing a good job of amplifying the problems. But it will only be the Liberals and the Nationals who have the capacity to fix it. Our job, though, is to persuade the Australian people that we have the right plan to do so.
Is the coalition going into some sort of coalition with the Liberal Party? Is that something that you would accept, or is it something that the Liberal Party should rule out?
Sally, I think you're asking whether or not we might go into a coalition with One Nation. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Yes, sorry.
Yeah. No, all good. Look, we have no plans to be going into a coalition with One Nation. Again, if we focus on the Australian people, if we focus on developing substantive policy, if we focus on removing this very poor Albanese government, that puts us in good stead. So, you know, I'm personally not looking around at any major structural change trying to engage with One Nation under some formal coalition.
So should any coalition between the Liberal Party and One Nation, should that be ruled out completely?
Look, I don't believe in preemptively ruling things in or out, but the point being, it's not on the table.
Shadow Minister Ted O'Brien there. He also told Sally that he wasn't worried about any further coalition members defecting to One Nation. We'll just have to wait and see. So how is Labor reading the developments in Farah? It didn't field a candidate in the by-election, but that doesn't mean it hasn't been watching closely. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, joined Sally Sara on this morning's Radio National Breakfast program for a post-mortem of just what happened in Farah.
Over the weekend, we saw One Nation win its first lower house seat in the Farah by-election. Why do you think so many voters embraced One Nation?
I think the Liberal Party and National Party made a big mistake legitimising One Nation and saying in adopting many of their policies but a lighter version of them, and then following that up by giving them preferences, they were saying effectively that it was okay to vote for One Nation rather than the traditional Conservative Party. So I think also there's been a great deal of disappointment with the breakup of the coalition, not once but twice, the removal of a leader who had represented, of course, that seat in Susan Lee for 25 years, but who was removed without even being given the opportunity to do a single budget reply. And the way that that was done, having these meetings on the day of the funeral of one of their former colleagues, I think left an extraordinary legacy of betrayal for people who had supported Susan Lee for a long period of time. And also, quite clearly, there's a lot of people under financial pressure who feel like the system isn't working for them. And that's a message for all political parties in the system.
What do you say to people who voted One Nation on the weekend?
Oh, I respect people's right to vote whatever way they determine, but One Nation, of course, is not a party of government. They are a political party led by someone who's promoted grievance rather than solutions. And I understand, though, a protest vote will be cast. In this case, it was a devastating result, I think, for Angus Taylor and the Liberal Party.
You were definitive before the election that you would not pursue changes to negative gearing and capital gains tax. Why are you about to break a promise, and does that play into the narrative of some people's exasperation with the major parties?
Tomorrow we'll deliver a budget that is focused on relief for working people, on resilience for our economy and for reform. And my top priority is looking after Australians today. But how do we set Australia up for a secure future? And we know people are under pressure. And the easy path is to say, oh, well, we'll just sit back and watch that occur. The difficult decision, but the right decision, is to do the right thing with the right policies to deliver. And clearly people are frustrated. Issues like intergenerational equity. People are worried that younger Australians are never going to get a crack at home ownership. And that's not just the young people themselves, of course. That's their parents and their grandparents.
Prime Minister, does winning 94 seats, in your view, give you a mandate to do the things that you didn't take to the election?
I made it very clear when I went to the National Press Club that we were determined to deliver on the commitments that we'd made and to do that quickly. Last year has been a year of delivery, but we also said that wasn't the limit of our ambition. There's a range of measures that we've had to take to respond. You'd recall we certainly didn't say that we would cut fuel taxes, but we've done that in response to the circumstances which are there. We'll respond appropriately.
But the circumstances that are here now when it comes to intergenerational equity, how are they different from what they were before the last election?
How they are different is that they continue to be entrenched without reform. And that's the point. For a long period of time, young people have tried to save for a home. Another year has passed since the election, and not enough has changed. And so many people have had another year of missing out at auctions, of renting and paying someone else's mortgage, and too many young people are close to giving up on the opportunity of owning their own home.
Briefly to the United Kingdom, in local elections there, there's been a big swing towards a Reform UK and also towards the Greens. Keir Starmer's leadership seems to be in some trouble. He's a friend of yours and you gave a keynote speech last year at the UK Labour Party gathering. Do you hope that he stays as Prime Minister?
He is a friend of mine and I hope that Keir Starmer continues to serve as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. He was elected a relatively short period of time. I've dealt with four prime ministers of Great Britain since I was elected as prime minister. And the revolving door of leaders does not lead to stability. We've had in Australia, of course, we had four elected prime ministers removed in a relatively short period of time. One of the things that I think assists my government is the fact that we have had one prime minister, one treasurer, one finance minister, one defence minister, one energy minister, one foreign minister in a period of time now for almost 4 years. So that brings stability and means you can get things done. And I think that is important, and I don't want to see the UK go down the road that Australia went in and then the UK followed for a period of time.
And that is the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, there, speaking with Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast. So while we're talking about the challenges facing his counterpart in the UK, Prime Minister Keir Starmer, just how safe is the British Prime Minister? We turned to Politico for some analysis. Their executive editor is Anne McElvoy. She co-hosts the Politics at Sam and Anne's daily podcast, and she laid out the dynamics at play.
There is a pincer movement now on the government, which is very brutal. It has the Reform Party, that's the party of Nigel Farage, a populist party to the right of the old Conservative Party, coming after it in a lot of its old heartlands, industrial heartlands, but not only there. It's creeping more, if you like, into middle-class Britain and eclipsing the Conservative Party. At the same time, it is shedding votes to the Greens on the more progressive wing and those who simply like their politics to sound more progressive than they think that Keir Starmer has been able to achieve. So it's really in a bit of a vice-like grip at the moment, and that has weakened the leadership to the possibly fatal point for Keir Starmer.
And why is this happening now, in your view?
Well, it's happening now because we have local elections and they're big ones. It gives you a very good snapshot of how the country's feeling. Answer: not good about Keir Starmer, as I was pointing out, losing at both ends of the spectrum. On top of that, you have Scotland and Wales. Now, they are much smaller electorates, but they are, of course, constituent parts of the United Kingdom. So if you lose control there, Labour thought they'd be able to take back Scotland, nowhere near. And now they've even got Reform coming after them north of the border. That one would not have predicted a few years ago. Scotland being more left-leaning in general. And in Wales, you've got the same sort of picture. You've got nationalists surging, but really a lot of discontent.
Do you think that Sir Keir Starmer's leadership is safe?
No, it's not at all safe. It's not at all safe. We know that because we've had a stalking horse candidate, Australian born as it happens. If you want to bring real drama into UK politics, yeah, just rely on bringing an Australian. It's going to happen. Catherine West is a very feisty MP. She doesn't have any aspirations herself to be the leader. But what I think she has called out is this sense of inertia and the fact that cabinet ministers, I speak to a lot for the political podcast that I host here, that they're kind of quite scared. They're a bit stuck. They give Keir one more chance, but they don't really think it's going to work. And what she's saying is this isn't good enough. I'm prepared to put my head above the parapet. In the British system, that's quite useful because there's a whole tradition of you don't want to dip your own hand in blood. But if somebody else does it, then you can say, well, actually, look, tens of MPs, you need about 81 to make a considerable challenge, are now hurtling towards this stalking horse candidate. Well, you know, if I'm, say, Wes Streeting, health secretary, got a good story to tell, bit of a kind of across the middle of the Labour Party guy, but a very good communicator, you're quite happy with that. You don't have to do the business. Or Angela Rayner, a bit to the left of that, quite flamboyant redhead. I like that being a redhead myself, she sits more to the left of the party. They don't want to go into the battle, but if somebody else starts it and it looks like Keir is wobbling, well, they're ready to strike. So no, sorry, long answer, short question, he is not safe.
And that is the Politico executive editor Anne McElvoy talking about the situation facing Keir Starmer. We're going to end today with a quick mention of the situation in Iran, because this morning Tehran said it had responded to Washington's latest peace proposal, and pretty quickly the US President Donald Trump said the reply was totally unacceptable. So what do we make of the reply? And could the US be misreading Iran's position and its leverage at the negotiating table? Jennifer Gavito is the former US Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Iraq and Iran. Take a listen to a little of what she told Sally.
So the Iranians themselves are saying that it was a constructive response, presumably inching closer to some sort of off-ramp or middle ground. However, I think what has been most interesting, despite in not having much detail yet on it, is the response that we saw from President Trump himself over the last couple of hours, which indicates that maybe the United States is not entirely pleased with what they've seen.
In what way? What do you mean?
I suspect that the Iranians are holding firm to some of their red lines. The president, you know, had a fairly belligerent response. And so I think that probably the U.S. administration was expecting Iran to be more flexible in some of its positions. It continues to be a problem that I think the Trump administration believes that it is negotiating with an adversary that has been defeated. And I don't think that the Iranians see themselves that way.
Has the United States, the Trump administration, underestimated the effect of the asymmetry of this conflict?
Certainly, I think the resilience of the Iranian response has, in fact, surprised the Trump administration. Their asymmetric objectives or capabilities have been well known for some time. It's actually, in a lot of ways, their conventional capabilities and their ability to continue, for example, to fire missiles that has, I think, put this administration on their back heels, and that the Trump administration had declared early on that most of the missile stockpiles had been depleted. And yet we've seen this week continued aggression against the UAE in particular, suggesting that that isn't entirely true.
Is Iran in a hurry to reach some sort of agreement, or how much longer can it withstand the current situation militarily and economically?
I think that Iran is showing that it's fairly resilient in this. One advantage that it has, as it were, is that doesn't necessarily prioritize the well-being of its people. So while the economic blockade is no doubt having a significant impact, I don't think that that's a primary concern of the Iranian regime itself. And so I think that the regime can hold out still, you know, for a considerable amount of time, and increasingly seems to believe that it has time on its side, assessing that the Trump administration is far more eager to get to a deal, given the ongoing disruptions to global shipping and the continuing rise of energy prices. And so Iran will, I think, draw this out as long as it can, expecting that the Trump administration will become more and more eager to strike a deal, and thus may end up being more flexible in some of its positions the longer this continues.
Jennifer Gavito there, the former US Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Iraq and Iran, talking about how the US may be misreading Iran's leverage at the negotiating table. Well, thank you so much for listening to all those interviews. Presented by Sally Sara and produced by the Radio National Breakfast team, Oscar Coleman helped produce the Breakfast Wrap today, and I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. We'll be back in your ears tomorrow.